Futurized goes beneath the trends, tracking the underlying forces of disruption in tech, policy, business models, social dynamics, and the environment. Join me, futurist Trond Arne Undheim, PhD author, investor, and serial entrepreneur, as I discuss the societal impact of deep tech such as AI, blockchain, IoT, nanotech, quantum, robotics, and synthetic biology, and tackle topics such as entrepreneurship trends for the future of work. I'm a research scholar in global systemic risk, innovation, and policy at Stanford University. On Futurized, I interview smart people with a soul, founders, authors, executives, and other thought leaders, or even the occasional celebrity. Futurized is a bi-weekly show preparing you to think about how to deal with the next decade's disruption so you can succeed and thrive no matter what happens. Futurized, conversations that matter. If you're new to the show, seek particular topics, or are looking for a great way to tell your friends about the show, we've got the episode categories. Those are at futurized.org/episodes. I am the co-author of Augmented Lean, a human-centric framework for managing frontline operation, and the author of Health Tech, Rebooting Society's Software, Hardware, and Mindset, Future Tech, How to Capture Value from Disruptive Industry Trends, Pandemic Aftermath, How Coronavirus Changes Global Society, The Disruption Games, How to Thrive on Serial Failure, and of Leadership from Below, How the Internet Generation Redefines the Workplace. For an overview, you can go to trondundheim.com/books. At this stage, Futurized is lucky enough to have several sponsors. And to check them out, go to futurized.org/sponsors. If you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or to get an overview of other services provided by me, including how to book me for keynote speeches, please go to futurized.org/store. We'll consider all brands that have demonstrably positive contributions to the future. Before you do anything else, make sure you are subscribed to our newsletter on futurized.org, where you can find hundreds of episodes of conversations that matter to the future. Please also leave a positive review on iTunes. Thanks so much.
Florian, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the invitation. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm excited too. So we'll talk about some pretty dire potential consequences of disasters and calamities. But you work for an organization that has figured out a way to work on this. But first of all, I wanted to just introduce you to people. So Florian, you're a winemaker. First of all, very important. We'll chat about that. So you grew up in a wine region in Rheingau. That's cool. Mm. I'm also into wine, so we can, let's keep it positive here. Can't just talk about the end of the world. But you're an environmental scientist, basically.
Yeah.
By background. And you've worked on food security, climate issues, but also on what we're talking about today, civilizational resilience, and specifically kind of extreme food security. Mm-hmm. And you have, I guess, a passion for all of these large questions. We'll get to them. But in a former life, I believe you were an expert on riverbeds. So we'll talk about rivers. I think that's really cool. And river behavior. I was intrigued by that. Either way, Florian, you now work for this nonprofit called All Fed, so the Alliance to Feed the Earth in Disasters. Mm-hmm. I was curious about that for lots of reasons. I thought that there were a bunch of very serious international organizations working on food security. Can you just, before we sort of get to the whole thing, what was the instigation of this organization, and how did you find it? How did you come to this organization on this topic?
Yeah, the idea behind the Alliance to Feed the Earth in Disasters is that while it's obviously always better to make sure that a catastrophe doesn't happen, and this is also what most of the organizations in global food security are focusing on, is here's the day, okay, let's assume the disaster happened. What can we do afterwards, and what can we do to make sure that nobody is starving in such events? The way that I ended up at AllFed is that, as you mentioned, I did my PhD about hydrology and river behavior. But during my PhD, I kind of noticed that my research probably won't make much of a difference. So if I would stop today, nobody would probably really care about my PhD research, and I wanted to do something more impactful. Then I contacted Effective Thesis, this organization that connects like PhD, master, bachelor students with organizations that do impactful work. They connected me with AllFat. I volunteered there for some time. And when my first postdoc finished, where I did some climate work, then AllFat was also looking for new positions. And I applied. I got the job, and now for 1.5 years, I've been working there on global food security.
I was just curious about rivers. I think rivers are, let's start with rivers. They're just fantastic.
Definitely.
I've been intrigued by these, the fact that rivers obviously was a massive reason why people created cities. You know, they cleared cities close to rivers because they were resources. But rivers are also famously very hard to control, and erosion and all of that stuff is really a massive problem, you know, throughout civilization. I've been taking an interest in this. I don't know if you worked on that specifically, but these kind of baskets that the Egyptians were creating, and then the Italians, to these cages essentially to stem erosion in rivers. It's a fantastic metaphor for what we're trying to do with existential risk, I find, right? To kind of intervene in nature's course by these like simple, small, little human tricks to try to, I guess, control nature.
Yeah, that's true. And I also in another hydrology project I really like, there's this one kind of desert patch in the US, and what they did there is they kind of installed like boulders and other materials that block the water in the small rivers there, and this led to so much infiltration that they have water there the whole year around. And so it's just like this small valley of green in the middle of the desert, just by basically putting some rocks into a river.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So anyway, but we'll get back to that. I was blanking on what this, these technologies are called for a second. I'm going to look that up, but anyway, let's go to food security here, and tell me really what the starting problem is. What is it that makes you so concerned that this could become a massive problem? And then we'll talk about some of the solutions that you are devising, working on this, both sort of publishing academic papers and I guess suggesting kind of really survival strategies for, you know, on the food side of these disasters. Maybe you can kind of line up the biggest and scariest thing altogether and tell us a little bit, you know, are these sort of natural disasters that you are the most worried about as a cause agent, or is it human created or specifically technological disasters, or is it a mixture?
I think like to get back to the first part of the question, I think the general idea is that the food system in and of itself is just like quite vulnerable to changes of the status quo. So obviously if you have plants, then you need continuous light and enough water, you need pesticides, you need fertilizers to let them grow. And all of these things can be like easily disrupted if you have like a big catastrophe. And this means that in such a case, the yields would drop considerably. And the other problem is that we don't really have such a big global food storage. So depending on when you would look in the year, you would have something like 6 months of food around globally before we would run out. And this means that if you have something that disrupts this production, you need to find some alternatives relatively quickly. In general, we look both like in man-made disasters, but also in natural ones. I think the main deciding factor on what kind of events we're looking at is the size that they are influencing the food system. So we are basically looking at everything that could create a global food shock that is bigger than 5%. So to put this in perspective, if you look at the food production data of the Food and Agriculture Organization, they have good data since 1961. And in this time, I think the biggest shock was something like 3.5%. But if we look deeper in the past, then we have those bigger catastrophes much often. So one example is just big volcanoes. And we could expect that, for example, with the eruption of the Tambora in the 19th century, that this led to such a food shock in the range that we are looking at.
Right. So what you're saying is if a super volcano were to erupt again, you know, obviously with a much larger population, we would need a kind of a massive sort of systemic answer to this thing to avoid really mass casualties and starvation.
Yeah, definitely. So if we would have something on the size of the Tambora or even bigger, then we would also expect that we would have a food shock of 5% and above globally, definitely.
Mm. Have you guys worked on probabilities for these things happening, or are you kind of more taking the attitude that you want to be the organization that is, I guess, the global hothouse for the solutions if these things were to happen?
Yeah, we're definitely more on the solution side. We haven't done any or original research to really like pinpoint the exact occurrence rate, but this has also been done by other researchers, like, for example, the Center for the Study of Existential Risk. The researchers there did some research about how often we can expect large volcanoes to erupt globally. And the probabilities that other people found are kind of like our motivation, because they are high enough that it is something we should definitely care about.
Yeah. Can we talk about nuclear technology and nuclear winter specifically? Because that's one that, you know, you were part of the authors and speakers at our event last year, where we now have these conference proceedings. And in that paper, you wrote about the sort of compounding effects of nuclear winter and overstepping planetary boundaries. So there's a mixture of sort of catastrophe that would occur, you know, in such an event. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see nuclear winter and what research you were building on there, and what would essentially happen after a nuclear winter that would precipitate such a shock?
Yeah, the basic idea of nuclear winter is that you must have a nuclear war. Then in the nuclear war, you would have the exchange of atomic weapons. And from the knowledge we have, we think that this would create large fires in these cities that were hit. This in turn creates like a chimney effect, which pulls like soot in the upper atmosphere, where it can stay for several years, up to a decade. Then this means, if you have those sunlight blocking particles like high above the atmosphere, you just get fewer sunlight to the surface of the Earth in total. And this in turn then means that everything gets just like considerably colder. And like the paper you mentioned, the idea there was to kind of imagine, okay, we are also doing like other things on the planet which influence the habitability of it, like overstepping how much we put pressure on the biodiversity, for example. And I wanted to do kind of a literature review and finding, okay, how might these two negative events interact with each other?
Yeah, and the strange thing, of course, is that all of the climate efforts that collectively are happening right now to try to cool the planet would obviously not be enormously helpful in a situation where the planet rapidly cools in an undesirable way, you know, from a different causal agent. So it was a kind of a striking paper, actually. It made me think a little bit because, you know, the not just politically correct, but the sort of the only sane attitude to climate change is to do something about it. But you are pointing out, you know, quite clearly, obviously, that if such an event happened, there would be some really adverse effects of having put in motion a kind of alternative cooling strategy that would be ongoing, and perhaps you couldn't even stop because you had put it in motion. You know, there are these theories about, you know, if you start doing other types of geoengineering, you know, you kind of have to keep it going, otherwise you don't know what's going to happen. So there are some interaction effects, and it was interesting. I think the whole idea of starting to understand the cascading changes that we are either just experiencing or trying to influence by human action, science, technology, other things, we really seem to be in the beginning of that. Is this sort of cascading idea, is this something you work on as well, or are you really, really narrowly focused on creating food strategies?
Yeah, I think this whole idea of cascading risk is coming more into the focus, both in my own work, but also I feel like in the global catastrophic risk community in general, because like the whole field of global catastrophic risk research is still relatively new. And so the obvious first thing was to look at the different things that could happen, like supervolcanic eruptions, for example, in isolation, because before you can look at interaction and cascading risks, you first have to understand what a single event could cause. But the thing is that if we look into the real world, then many of the big catastrophes and negative effects that we could experience are in a somewhat cascading nature, be it like even looking at the things that we looked at, like the volcanoes. When you want to understand how this would play out, ultimately you would also have to know how the economics, for example, would react, or like food trade in general.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's almost, well, I don't know, surprising, I guess, you know, it's just, you know, it's a busy world when you start thinking about these things. And, you know, the scientific instinct is to try to isolate factors and, you know, write small papers on smaller and smaller things. The challenge, of course, is that these problems are the opposite of that scientific inclination. So do you feel that that's challenging, or is it easier when you work on sort of these applied questions, but with a sort of a scientific mind, however, inside of an NGO? Has this been kind of liberating to you? Is that one of the reasons you were attracted to this problem, that you were actually able to work on something, you know, in a deep way, but with less kind of, I guess, boundaries of an institution where you're, you know, I guess, publish or perish or something?
Yeah, but there was definitely a motivation. Like, I like that I can do now more work where the main motivation is like, okay, we have to understand this better. How can we understand this better?
Right.
And it's also like great to have the opportunity to work on such a like big variety in topics. I did the paper that you mentioned with the planetary boundaries. The last big project was about like seeing how seaweed would grow after a nuclear winter. What I'm working on now is where I'm using a simplified trait model that tries to understand, okay, how would those different global catastrophes influence the global trade networks? It's just like really interesting and engaging work.
Yeah, I think those, you know, the kind of work where you're sort of questioning several societal systems at once and trying to model or look at the impacts, these are very, very important. Let's jump to food for a second. I was reading a little bit on the website, and you mentioned seaweed. So let's assume that some catastrophe has happened. You have now worked on a bunch of different I guess you call them disaster resilient foods. So this is not just, you know, food security. Like there are some systematic, obviously, you know, feeding parts of the world that generally have a lower amount of food. You're sort of saying, assuming a disaster hits literally almost every place on the planet. That seems to be the assumption. So you have a scenario almost, you know, in mind already. I saw that you have worked on some high-tech type foods, but there's also low-tech solutions. Can you kind of line up the different options that one would have in such a scenario, and what are the most feasible ones sort of short-term, and what are the ones that are more scalable long-term to feed, you know, millions of people?
Yeah. I think like one of the more important things there is just like you don't really have like a silver bullet that solves all your problems there. We have been looking into like a wide variety of foods, and you need quite a lot of them because they all have their advantages or disadvantages. But to make some examples of the different things we've looked at, so one of more of the low-tech side is the seaweed I mentioned earlier, because seaweed like is already a food we grow now, and where it would also be good if we would grow even more of it now, because like the food and agricultural organizations, for example, they publish a new report every 10 years where they state, hey, it would be great if everybody would eat more seaweed, because then humanity would be much more food secure. And this is not only the case for like now, but also according to our research, after like events that reduce incoming sunlight, like nuclear winter. The advantage of seaweed there is that it's just like, it's pretty low tech, so you can farm it without like very big prerequisites. And it also just like can grow really fast, which is also really important if you think about scaling up the production so it can replace the food system we have now.
And have you done, or is there research showing that it can actually grow under low sunlight conditions? Because so the water, nothing would happen, or would there be lower growth rates during such a nuclear winter scenario?
It would certainly be lower growth rates. But the thing is, if you imagine something like a volcanic or a nuclear winter, it's not that basically the whole world is pitch black for 10 years. But it's more like a crater on a curve. So especially it depends on where on the globe you are. So if you are closer to the equator, then things remain much brighter and warmer than in comparison with, let's say, Central Europe. This is also what we found when we were modeling the seaweed growth, that most of the places where it would make sense to grow seaweed in such scenarios are also those that are closer to the equator. This also brings me to another solution that we've been looking at, is where you just grow plants at different places than they were grown now. Because if you look at the predicted climate impacts, you would have, for example, in the Amazon basin, after a nuclear war, a climate that is much more similar to like places in the US or in Europe. And this also means that the plants we grow here now would be able to grow there in the event of such a scenario. So you would have to move the seeds we have here to the places where it could be grown after global catastrophe.
Well, seeds seem to be pretty important in this business.
Definitely.
I grew up in Norway, and you know, one of the big reasons why people emigrated was obviously food shortages and you know, very limited agriculture. But we did grow potatoes. So you're saying, you know, get the Scandinavian potatoes down to Africa, essentially. So suddenly you'd be growing cold climate crops on the equator line.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. And how do you foresee that such a scale of sort of seed transfer and knowledge transfer for, you know, to do all these things? Have you thought about logistically how these things might happen and who would finance these kinds of, I guess, infrastructure, you know, food and ag infrastructure projects, you know, built up on the fly like that?
Yeah, like in general, our research is at many places still more on the side of like trying to figure out if these things are possible, like in general. But if we want to also make sure that this would really work after global catastrophes, we would also need like government buy-in, and also, for example, they could fund more research, but also like even taking the time to thinking through, okay, what could this specific country do in a variety of big catastrophes would make a big difference.
One of the other foods that or ways of growing methods, you talked about simple greenhouses. So these are not the advanced greenhouses that you see in German cities these days, right? With, you know, vertical agriculture growing in these temperature controlled, you know, greenhouses. What do you have in mind there?
Like you already said, those are, there's the idea that for many places, where it gets too cold outside to grow the foods that you usually grow there, you could build like low-tech greenhouses. This is just a bit of wood and a plastic sheet, and then you have already greenhouse. Then you could use those to make it warmer, because the heat is trapped under the greenhouse, and therefore you could still grow the food there even though it got colder.
Yeah, not to throw a wrench into your plan, though, but how do you get plastic?
Definitely. This is also in the direction of having to prepare for this in some way. So everything we're proposing would be much harder if nobody does any preparation. And this is also, I think, like a good like general call, like that it would be really good if like there would go more money into like preparation research and also like preparation planning in general. And I think the like COVID-19 pandemic is just like a really good example of where we would have probably had a much easier time if we had prepared more.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, you know, all of these things have dependencies, and you know, plastic is an, you know, polyurethane is an industrial product in and of itself. So I'm just wondering, you know, if you suddenly caught off guard with this, and you have to improvise a greenhouse, there aren't all that many options apart from glass and plastic that I know about where the sun actually gets through. So I'm just curious. That seems to be a, you know, could become a challenge if you're really talking about the, you know, every factory in the world going down. And, you know, I don't know if you would have access to the oil reserves, but I guess if you have, you know, as long as you have petroleum, you could start making oil-based products. But it's just striking again how connected all of these things are, right?
Yeah, they're definitely connected. And this is also like one of the big challenges in such research in general, because you have so many moving parts you have to connect to really see if this is possible. And the problem with the greenhouses you mentioned, like this research was done before I started off it, so I don't have all the details. But I think in the paper, they also propose some solutions on where you could make sure that you have enough of this plastic sheet.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the more high-tech solutions? I guess that's kind of the first that comes to mind to people. You know, you imagine some sort of sci-fi brilliant scientist coming up with this fantastic sort of Mars or moon-based type food that you imagine we're going to have when we create bases on these various, you know, planets and the bodies, you know, in outer space. What are some of the more high-tech ways that you think can be used? Deployed to create products? Are these mushroom-based advanced, advanced new type of yields, or are they what sort of materials are you basing these more high-tech solutions on?
The mushrooms are definitely interesting, but when we're talking about like the high-tech solutions, the one I probably find most fascinating is so-called single-cell protein. And this is where you have kind of a bioreactor where you put nutrients in, and then you just have like microorganisms in there. They eat the nutrients, and then you can kind of eat the microorganisms themselves. You get kind of like a protein-rich paste powder. And this all is something that already exists right now. I think you're mainly using it for fish fodder, but there are also plans to give this to humans as well, because it would just be a very cheap protein source if you scale it up efficiently.
Is that what in sci-fi movies people are always complaining about when the taste is not so good?
Possibly. I haven't tried it yet myself. The world would probably get a lot less spicier after global catastrophes.
I see. So we're back to kind of the basics, huh? So there would be very little gourmet food here.
Probably.
Interesting. All right. So tell me, so apart from doing research on how to produce food, are you working with stakeholders in any other ways? Are you trying to influence various stakeholders to implement some of these stockpiling or testing, or even, I guess, what comes to mind for me would be that the food and ag industry and their existing infrastructure, there could be some sort of planning there already. I guess COVID was one thing that kind of got people on that idea, right? The fact that there are things that these factories could do to just retool very quickly to basically epidemic production, similar to, you know, the concept of wartime production. And I was just wondering if you have some ideas for how the food and ag industry's existing infrastructure could be retooled in this way.
Yeah, to talk about this, like specifically one thing we would like to do, but where we haven't had the funding yet for, is to repurpose like paper mills, because paper mills can be repurposed to create sugar, because if you break down cellulose, you can also just use slightly different techniques and not get paper at the end, but sugar. The problem is that paper mills don't come cheap, so we hadn't had yet the fund to buy one. But in general, we definitely also looking at stakeholders and trying to influence policymaking in the way that we hope that more funding goes into this kind of research in general, because there is just like a lot of different ideas we kind of have in store and that we could research if more funds would be available. But also what I also mentioned earlier is like getting governments to make response plans, because preparation is just very key in many of the solutions and also scenarios we looked at.
Yeah, on that, have you looked at that at all? Are there any governments that stand out for having made any kind of food emergency plan? I haven't looked at this issue myself, but I'd be surprised if large governments, I mean, certainly the EU must have financed a bunch of R&D projects looking at food crisis scenarios. So that must be an entity where a lot of that modeling and work has been done. But if you think about individual nations, do you know if any nations stand out as actually having worked on this?
For like smaller food shocks, I think like most nations have something in store, because it's just something that keeps on happening. Like you have a price spike and you have to be prepared for that somewhat, because you can expect it regularly. But when it comes to bigger things, then I think one example is the UK I'm not sure how deep they got into food research, but they recently created a new kind of like risk inventory where they tried to look at all the different risks that the UK could befall. And there they also highlighted for the first time very big volcanic eruptions, for example. And if you start looking at this, you necessarily also come to the food system at some point, because it's just like the obvious pinch point for many of those catastrophes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It is such a basic system, right? And we depend on it so much, and it has also become so industrialized, right? So do you have any recommendations for individuals? I'm thinking, you know, there's a whole kind of organic movement out there. There's a whole movement of people saying we should all learn agricultural techniques, maybe not just for crisis, but actually to get in touch with, you know, with yourself and, you know, with what we're made of and what it is to be human and has been to be human, you know, for centuries and millennia. What is your advice to individuals in terms of what they should do around this? Is there an action that an individual should take based on your insight?
Like on a very, very basic level, it's just good preparedness in general. If you have some food around for like a few weeks and also water, so you are prepared for all kinds of bad events happening in the world, that is like a generally good idea for everyone. But the thing is that for many of the interventions that AllFed work on, they are probably only really effective if you do them on a large scale. But the thing is, besides my work at AllFed, I also do some research about societal collapse in general and write about that a lot. And one of the insights, or more the of the topics that come up there again and again, is that democracies just seem way better than in handling like bad events and catastrophes than all other types of governments. And so like from my personal conclusion from this is more like the most important thing on a local level you yourself can do is probably make sure that your local democracy is intact and strong so it can prepare for disasters in general.
And why is that, Florian? It's because if something bad goes down, then if you have a democracy, then everybody would start to distribute resources and do kind of rational things that save the most amount of people. But in autocracies or other types of governance forms, they would immediately concentrate the resources at the top. Is that kind of the finding?
Yeah, kind of. Like from what I've read so far, it seems to me that this is still an ongoing debate in the scientific community why democracies are really better at this. But like one of the arguments that I've seen most often is just the idea that if you have a democracy, then every person living in this democracy is your stakeholder and not only like a tiny elite. And therefore, the whole idea of democracy is like making sure that the resources are distributed equally enough and that everybody is taken care of. And if this is the basic idea of your government, then you will also continue to work under this assumption when the big catastrophe happens.
It's fascinating work. Societal collapse. What kind of community is that? You know, who is involved in thinking about societal collapse from your point of view? I mean, we had this conference at Stanford. We gathered a bunch of people in the existential risk community. But when you say the societal kind of collapse community, who exactly are you thinking about?
It feels to me like this is a very, very varied community with lots and lots of people from all kinds of different fields. What you definitely see often is like historians, because they can look into the past and see, okay, what worked state-wise, what didn't work. What you also see a lot of is like economists, but it's because I feel like economists often comment on all kinds of issues. One of the most well-known sources, I think, is like Peter Turchin, and he was originally a biologist in his research, if I recall correctly. And at least the story of what I heard is that he kind of had the impression that he kind of solved biology and that he had to find a new, bigger, interesting field. And then he switched to societal collapse to solve this instead.
Interesting. Let's talk about the future for a second, because a lot of these things, they are assuming things that will happen in the future, which is problematic because most people don't think too much about the future and they assume that the future is either hard to predict and, you know, goodbye, let's not think about it too much, or perhaps they think, you know, all kinds of calamities could happen. I prefer not to think about it too much. In your field, thinking about the future must be kind of baked in. What do you think the next few decades are going to look like?
Like me personally, it could be going in like all directions, it feels like, because we have like many negative trends, many positive trends, and it just like feels very, very hard to really make like a firm prediction of what could happen in the future. But I'm pretty sure it's going to be a wild ride. This seems probable. But this also brings me back of like the idea of preparation, because there are lots of possible futures out there. Some are good, some are bad. But if we would prepare more for the bad ones, then in general, I think we have more brighter futures ahead of us.
So preparation for bad futures gives you a better future.
Yes, hopefully.
Yeah. It's not really a positive message to young people. You seem to be a smiling person, though. So it's possible to remain optimistic, even though you have this kind of, I guess, sobering assessment of where the world's going. I mean, your daytime is to worry about civilizational collapse.
Yeah, that's true. But the best case would be that my research will not be used at any time in the future. This would be like my kind of wish. I think it's also like there's a good chance that we will end up in one of the better futures, and we can make it more likely that we will end up in one of the better futures. And I think those are the factors that, even though I'm thinking about global catastrophes a lot, I'm still feeling like overall optimistic about the future.
I want to bring us back to rivers. I finally, the word I was looking for was gabions, you know, gabiones in Italian. So these boxes that they were using to you know, it's basically the Egyptian, I believe, just used hemp. And they created these hemp things and put sludge or rocks inside of them. And then you put them in riverbeds and you're basically using it as an anti-erosion tool. I don't know. I just think it's fascinating that throughout humanity, we have tried to control nature. And I don't know. I read this book recently by John McPhee, who talks, you know, control of nature. And he talks about all these big infrastructure projects that we try to do, you know, whether it is, you know, try to slow the lava in Iceland or in, you know, in California, they now have, you know, massive amount of sort of mudslides and rivers. And ravines, you know, just created out of all the rain, even, you know, last few weeks. Do you think it's possible to kind of win in this race against nature? I mean, am I getting this wrong? It's not like a race against nature, but do you feel like that's kind of humanity's place here, is just to try to continuously find ways to adapt that are, I guess, not too expensive and not too difficult? Is that what we are out here to do to survive?
Yeah, I feel like it's also just a lot of question about balance, to get back a bit about the planetary boundaries we talked about earlier. They are defined on the idea like this planet has only a certain amount of damage it can take before it breaks, in quotation marks. And therefore, we have to make sure that we stay within those boundaries and this place remains nice and warm and suitable for life for a long time. But even if you manage to stay in these boundaries, you will still have like challenges, because you will have events that are hard to avoid, like a super volcanic eruption at some point in the future. And so I think like my general idea is like you have to make sure that you don't overtax the planet. But if you do that, there will still be like adverse events. But in general, I think you can find a balance with the planet that allows you to stay here for a long time and have a good life for everyone.
Florian, to what extent are these, so we talked about high-tech and low-tech solutions, to what extent are all of these plans that we should make individually and as governments and as scientists, do they depend on advanced science and sort of this massive buildup of all of these technologies to handle these things? Or is it a mix of you seem to, with AlFed, to be advocating a little bit of a mix between fairly advanced things and fairly simple things, but in some way it needs to be coordinated. So it seems like you are, and you were talking about democracy. So you're implying a mix of high tech and low tech, but with some organizational principles. Does that sort of sum up kind of what we're looking at here? Because there are movements on the collapse side of things that are very, very extreme either way. Mm. And they say, you know, the fact that we could face calamity is a proof that we need to invest, you know, so much more in technology, or it is proof that we need to invest so much less because the changes are going too fast. We need to have a degrowth and we need to slow down. Mm. Where are you on the scale of, you know, investing tremendously or slowing down tremendously?
Probably somewhere in the middle. And it sometimes feels to me like this is maybe not the best or not the only discussions you should have, because what comes up in my own research again and again is just like cooperation is so important. And many of the problems that we have now are not there because we lack the technology to solve them. Like climate change, we kind of know how to solve climate change for 100 years. But the tricky thing is implementing it, and it often fails because humans have sometimes problem cooperating. And this is also why I'm making this call for democracy earlier, because I think that many of the problems we have could be solved if we manage to coordinate us better and like cooperate more.
Interesting. Just in the last few seconds here, fixing climate change, we've known it for 100 years. How would we fix it if we wanted to?
Like the global catastrophes, you have lots of little solutions that have to add up together. There's a nice plan by, I think, Project Drawdown, it's called. And they mapped out like lots of solutions. And if you all add them up together, you end up in a climate neutral future. And none of those solutions are some sci-fi stuff. It's just like getting girls more educated. This is something we could do right now if we choose to do so.
Interesting. Well, Florian, thank you for going through some of these things. You have certainly convinced me that working on a very specific problem that, you know, with some certainty will occur, at some point in humanity's future, is a worthwhile cause. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. This was a nice conversation.
You have just listened to another episode of the Futurized podcast with me, Trond Arne Undheim, futurist, scholar, and author. If you are interested in my products or services, feel free to check out futurized.org/store, where you can book a keynote speech, become a sponsor or partner, request a podcast swap, or buy a few of my books, such as Augmented Lean, Health Tech, Future Tech, Pandemic Aftermath, Disruption Games, or Leadership from Below. If you're interested in any or all of my projects, check out my website, trondundheim.com, which has links to other podcasts as well as my public appearances. Thank you. Please share this show with those you care about. To find us on social media is easy. We are Futurized on LinkedIn and YouTube, and Futurized2 on Instagram and Twitter. See you next time. Futurized, conversations that matter.